auto sales kick up into higher gear. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Tuesday, September the 4th. Coming up on the show, we're going to talk about those auto sales and find out why they're doing so much better than many other retailers who are selling other things, not quite at the pace of the auto companies right now. Also, we are going to look to the United Kingdom, which may offer some clues about what happens when you put in place fiscal austerity measures quickly. That's all coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Ford has announced its sales were up 12.6% last month compared with a year ago. Chrysler says its sales were up 14%. That is the 29th consecutive month of sales growth for Chrysler, and it was the company's best performance in 5 years. We'll hear from more car makers today, but to help us digest what is already coming in, let's bring in Julie Niemann. She's an analyst with Smith, Moore & Company, and she's with us now from St. Louis. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
So why does it seem like auto sales are on a planet of their own? I mean, most retailers would kill for 29 straight months of sales growth.
Absolutely. Well, a couple things. First of all, there's huge pent-up demand here in the United States for automobiles. We're driving old cars. We're driving close to the curb in case of a breakdown. You want to take a trip without having AAA on speed dial. Secondly, you've got a lot of really good financing incentives. You can get loans at the bank, but they're not really letting you have them. Auto dealers are really dealing here. They've got 0% in many cases here, so the financing is there. And finally, high prices of used cars. Cash for clunkers absolutely destroyed the used car market. People have more of an incentive to go to new cars rather than used cars. So we're looking at a period here of really good demand. And you have to clear out the years 2012. New cars coming in.
Well, what about that financing you were talking about? I mean, hasn't that been one of the reasons why the housing market has had such trouble rebounding is that people can't get loans? But you're saying that they can get the loans they need to buy a new car.
A couple of positive things. Household debt really has dropped by about $1.3 trillion since 2008. Part of that was due to bankruptcy, crude but effective way to get rid of debt. But consumers have also been fearful about job situation and paid down their debt. They're cautious about using credit cards, not so much when you're buying a long-term asset like cars. And if you get the good financing that auto dealers are offering, they're not as anxious about taking on the new kind of debt here.
Well, what about gas prices, Julie? I mean, they're heading higher at the moment. Is that influencing the kinds of cars that people are buying?
Hugely. $4 a gallon always focuses the driver's attention. Fuel efficiency is very important. Now, we are going to see gasoline prices go down simply because vacation's over, everybody's back to school, no heavy driving. It will come down just on a seasonal basis. But even the trucks are looking at good fuel efficiency. And the big strength this time was also in light vehicle sales where you have good fuel efficiency. So the consumer wants good fuel efficiency, you know, plus something new and kind of spiffy looking. They're getting it in the new models that are coming out now. At long last, you have auto dealers getting a product out that America wants.
Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith, Moore & Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has arrived in Beijing for 2 days of talks in China. Her visit comes amid a slowdown in the Chinese economy and an uptick in economic tensions between China and the United States. Sabri Benishore reports from Washington.
Secretary Clinton will have plenty on her plate these 2 days. Nicholas Lardy is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
It basically comes down to a range of trade issues. Is China trading fairly? There had been quite a bit of concern about the value of its currency over recent years, but the Chinese have allowed their currency to appreciate quite a bit.
The U.S. and China have a bunch of disputes at the World Trade Organization. Among them, the U.S. says China is subsidizing and dumping solar panels onto the world market, and the Chinese are peeved that the U.S. is going after them so aggressively at the WTO. Jonathan Pollack is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
This seems to me to be a time of real unease in the U.S.-China relationship.
Both countries face political uncertainty, and both are under serious economic strain. At the same time, a wave of nationalism across Asia and territorial disputes also complicate the relationship. I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Well, now to Charlotte, where Democrats kick off their national convention today. It will be a sharp contrast with last week's Republican convention, at least when it comes to economic ideas. Republicans called for immediate fiscal austerity, while Democrats say it's not such a great idea to cut very quickly while the economy is still in a fragile recovery. So as voters sort through the rhetoric, they might want to look to the UK economy, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
Some British politicians dream of a Churchill moment. In a national crisis, they come to the House of Commons and declare they're going to save the country from disaster. This was Finance Chief George Osborne's Churchill moment.
Today is the day when Britain steps back from the brink.
October 2010, Osborne declared war on Britain's budget deficit.
When we confront the bills from a decade of debt.
But almost 2 years on, the news from the front is not good.
The UK's double-dip recession deepens as the economy shrinks by far more than
expected. The economy has stalled, opposition spokesman Ed Balls.
There's a lack of confidence made much worse by the spending cuts, which we've always said have gone too far and too fast.
He claims the deficit reduction's been self-defeating. The cuts have shrunk the economy, tax revenues have fallen, and the deficit is widening again. A warning here, perhaps, for the US. But economist Andrew Hilton says the truth about Britain's budget cutting is more complicated.
We've been talking a lot of cuts. We simply haven't been making them yet. The cuts are in the pipeline. We haven't really begun to see the deepest of those cuts.
So just the prospect of the cuts hit confidence and helped tip the economy into recession. Why would the US want to follow the British example? Jeremy Warner of the Daily Telegraph.
Where the US can learn from the UK is that we do have a plan, and the UK has earned a lot of brownie points in international markets for that.
And so Britain has retained its AAA credit rating, making it easier to borrow. Of course, the US Treasury has no trouble borrowing for now, but Warner says that $1 trillion deficit will have to be tackled someday. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Campbell's Soup Company shares are up today after the company said its US soup sales heated up 9% last quarter. Meanwhile, The Gap is considering opening up shop in India. That's according to the Wall Street Journal, which says The Gap is expanding overseas, even though it is closing about a fifth of its clothing stores here in the U.S.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
There has been another shooting at a mine in South Africa. 4 people were wounded this time, just weeks after 34 striking workers were killed at another South African mine. Reporter Gretchen Wilson is with us from Johannesburg with more. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So first, what about this new incident at another mine?
Yes, just east of Johannesburg yesterday, 4 miners were injured when security guards used rubber bullets at protesters at a gold mine. These were miners who had been fired after going on strike in June for higher wages. They were discharged with minor injuries later in the day, but it really highlights the serious tensions at play in South Africa. This morning I spoke to Patrick Craven. He's with COSATU, South Africa's biggest trade union federation, and here's what he had to say.
Protests in South Africa, not only trade union protests, but community protests as well, have been coming increasingly violent and angry. We're sitting on a ticking time bomb. And what happened on the 16th of August is the bomb exploded.
Well, let's go back to that original incident back on the 16th of August at a platinum mine. What has happened to the mining industry, the all-important mining industry in South Africa since then?
Well, unrest is really spreading across South African mines. You can go in any direction from Johannesburg and you're going to bump into miners striking. Marikana was in the northwest and tens of thousands of workers are still striking there, demanding higher wages. But if you go west, you'll find 12,000 miners at the Goldfields Company who've downed tools who are also demanding a pay raise and also greater union representation.
And throughout all of this, have the workers gotten what they wanted? Higher wages, more of the benefits that go to these very lucrative mines?
Well, time is going to tell. Right now, I think in South Africa, we really see it as a watershed moment. It's really a wake-up call globally to the human side of extracting natural resources. And in South Africa, the mining industry was built on cheap, black, labor, oftentimes using very draconian measures. But the fact is, it's not that kind of world anymore, and workers are no longer going to tolerate the same kind of conditions that they would have tolerated or been forced to take part in 100 years ago.
Gretchen Wilson reporting from Johannesburg. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, there will be a lot of economic news later this week, both in Europe and the U.S. A meeting of the European Central Bank on Thursday, the August jobs report from the Labor Department on Friday. But as our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports, many Wall Street traders are waiting and watching rather than buying and selling.
This fall, expect fear and loathing on Wall Street. Swashbuckling investors like hedge funds usually love to take big investment risks, but now they're looking timid. Daryl Jones is the head of research for HedgEye Risk Management.
A lot of our subscribers are large hedge funds, and they're being very conservative. A lot of cash on the sidelines and or investing in assets like gold that they think are stable.
Many of the big guys are facing the same challenges as mom-and-pop investors. They're afraid to mess up. David Simon is the CEO of Twin Capital Management, a hedge fund.
A lot of hedge funds don't want to lose whatever little they're up.
Losing money is a very real risk this fall, with the uncertainty of the presidential election and the European crisis. But predictions often fail, says David Merkel. He runs Olive Investments.
To the extent that you try to play the prediction game, you run the risk that you will underperform your competitors.
Another big reason investors are holding back, they're hoping for more stimulus from the Federal Reserve. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, Nokia launches a new smartphone, which will use Microsoft's operating system. It's the last best chance for Nokia to take on Apple, which is expected to launch the next version of the iPhone this month. For a glimpse into the future of mobile, we've got Brian Chen on the line. He writes for the New York Times Bits blog. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what's next for mobile phones?
I think right now touchscreens are really big, looking at tablets, looking at smartphones. But for the future, I think Google gives us a good clue as to what we should expect with the glasses and the whole idea of wearable computing, the connected body. This idea of wearing glasses and being able to see data as we walk around is sort of where I think things are heading.
Sounds pretty dangerous if you're walking down the street and everybody's wearing glasses and reading books and watching movies and all that.
You know, I think the secret is I think people are going to have to figure out how to make the interface less noticeable and less intrusive. So I can imagine if you wanted to have some notes by your side, like say you were giving a speech, glasses could serve as sort of a teleprompter in some ways.
All right. Well, for those of us who are not going to be at the forefront of technology and might not be willing to plop down the amount of money necessary to be right on the cutting edge, what about the smartphones? I mean, what can they do next that will make them worth buying the next generation of?
I think what we can expect is for Apple and its competitors to keep iterating on what they're doing right now. And of course, I think there's always some opportunity to address certain areas of technology that doesn't work very well and implementing that into current devices.
And who are the players going to be? Is Apple going to be the leader going forward in this next generation of mobile technology with Google and other players behind? Or is anybody poised to take over that role?
Right now, Apple and, of course, Google are sort of ruling this market. Google is just becoming a hardware manufacturer now. So I think that's sort of like the big question. Is Google, as a hardware manufacturer with Motorola, going to become the big number two smartphone maker? Right now, the biggest phone maker in the world is Samsung. And, of course, there's been a lot of patent litigation between Apple and Samsung. So I think the future of Samsung is sort of uncertain in this area, depending on how this whole thing pans out.
I was walking down the street the other day and I saw somebody with a flip phone with an antenna on it. How long until that sight is a thing of the past?
Well, right now in the United States, more than 50% of phone users are using smartphones. And I think those types of phones are going to continue to evaporate as smartphones become more affordable and carriers continue to compete in terms of the prices of the contracts and so forth. Hopefully that sort of causes some change in the industry.
Brian Chen of the New York Times Bits blog, author of Always On, How the iPhone Unlocked the Anything, Anytime, Anywhere Future. Thank you so much for your time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
And finally, to one area of inflation that's probably making a lot of kids happy. According to a study out this morning from Visa, the tooth fairy is leaving kids an average of $3 per tooth these days. That is up 15% from last year. According to USA Today, Visa is launching an iPhone app today to calculate the going rate for teeth, just in case the tooth fairy is still stuck in the 1960s. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.